And you can begin by turning with me to chapter 23 of the book of Bereshit, or Genesis. And the parsha begins with the first few words there, which says, "And the life of Sarah." And basically, that life of Sarah is Chaye Sarah. It was 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And then basically what it tells us is that she died there in Kiriat Arba, the same place also called Hebron in the land of Canaan. And verses 2 and 3 are kind of interesting. I saw an interesting midrash as well on these earlier in the week, telling us a little bit about the character of Abraham with just a verse and a half. It says, "Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her." And you can understand after a century or more why that would be the case. And then it says in verse 3, "And Abraham rose up from before his dead, and he spoke, this time to the children of Heth." And we'll come back to what he said in just a second. But essentially, the commentary that I liked on that was, here is a fellow who is getting up there pretty far in age himself. And obviously, the mourning is intense. And there might have been a tendency. It's possible that, lesser men, if you will, might have just basically said, "I'm gonna pack it in. That's it." And yet, what we see here, it seems, is that Abraham still has things to do. He has a covenant and other items that we're going to talk about in this portion that need to be done. And he gets on with life. He resumes doing what needs to be done. And I really do like that. Now, the other thing I want to mention about this particular parsha before we go too far is that I'm going to call this the first overtly law and contract-oriented portion in the Scriptures. Now, we've certainly seen elements and things that have to do with covenant. And covenant is essential certainly the covenant that we have with Yah, arguably the most important thing, period, that we have. And this idea, too, of covenant pervades so much, well, at least should pervade much of our understanding of society. It's the essential element of marriage and so forth. But in this portion, we're going to see another couple of aspects of things that really form the entire basis for the legal system, starting with this first story here. And we'll go through it briefly. Abraham goes to the children of Heth. Now, these are Canaanites. And if you see how this plays out, you kind of get a little bit of insight into the character of this group as well. "I'm a stranger and a sojourner," he says. "So give me possession of a burying place with you, that I might bury my dead." And the children of Heth answered Abraham, and they basically said, "Don't worry about it. Hey, we'll give it to you. Not a problem. You're a mighty prince among us," says verse 6. "In the choice of our sepulchers, bury your dead. No one would withhold anything like this from you. You may bury your dead." And Abraham rose up. He is polite. He says, he bowed down to the children of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, "If it be in your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and entreat for me to a fellow whose name is," and he identifies him, "Ephron, son of Zohar, that he may give to me what he was looking to buy." Abraham wants to buy this cave called the Cave of Machpelah, which he has. And literally, it looks like the meaning of that word Machpelah has to do with doubled. "It's in the end of his field, and I'm going to give him the full price. Let him give it to me in the midst of you for a possession of a burying place." Now, I'll skip some of the rest of the interesting exchange here. We'll come back to it a second. But again, I want to go back to this idea of law and contract, because there are several elements that would be what would now be called the basis, the fundamental precepts of contract law that we see happening right here before us. One is the idea of offer and acceptance. Abraham makes an offer. He makes it more than once. We're going to see that eventually it gets accepted. We're also going to see that it gets accepted in front of witnesses. Now, normally, Torah says two or three witnesses, that ought to be sufficient. And if you got offer and acceptance right there, that's two people. If they are people of integrity, that would be enough. That would be a done deal. But it's nice that there are other people here as well. And, of course, what we're going to find out in addition is this particular exchange, this contract, and indeed this deed, has been recorded in probably the most reliable and important place that it could possibly be recorded in Scripture. So to some extent, what we're looking at here is the oldest recorded land contract and deed in all of human history. So it's no wonder that it gives us a whole lot of detail about how it plays out. Ephron was sitting there, and the Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham, and it says this, in the hearing of the children of Heth. Now, there you go. There's the witnesses. Even of all that were in the gate of the city. And the scripture is emphasizing that point. These are the, if you will, the gate of the city is the place where business, where contract, where the legal matters were decided. So all of this is making the same point. Nay, my lord, he says, hear me. That field, I'm going to give it to you. You just take it. Cave that's there, I give it to you. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. Well, Abraham's still polite. He says, before the people of the land, he bows down and he says, in the hearing of the people of the land. Did you notice it keeps emphasizing this idea of witnesses again? If you will, I pray you, hear me. I'll give you the price of the field. Take it from me so I can bury my dead there. And Ephraim answered. Now, this is where the plot thickens. My lord, hearken to me. That land, and then here he's going to name a ridiculous price. That land's worth an incredible, awesome, amazing sum of money. 400 shekels of silver. But hey, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead. Well, says Abraham, he's not even going to dicker. He doesn't want that said either, evidently. He hearkened to Ephron, and he did the following. Now listen to this. He weighed out to Ephron the silver, which he had named in the hearing of the children of Heth. 400 shekels of silver, current money, current trade of the merchant. Now remember, the word silver there is kasef, same word that is used for money. Kasef, kasef. So it's telling us a number of things. One, honest weights and measures. This was a contract made in the presence of witnesses, 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 in the hearing thereof. We heard that a number of times. There are more than two or three of them. There was offer. There was acceptance. Ephron the Hittite named a price. Abraham said, no problem. I'll pay it. He weighed it out. The witnesses saw it, and now we have it recorded. So verse 17 says, the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field, the cave, all the trees in the field, all the things around the border thereof, were made sure unto Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth before all that went in at the gate of the city. I mean, how is that for some legal terminology? You want to see when Scripture lays things out for us so that we understand the principles and how it's done. Here is a template, if you will, for a land deal. And after that, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave in Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave therein were made sure unto Abraham for a possession, a burying place by the children of Heth. They guaranteed it. And here you go, thousands of years later, that written deed is still right here before us. There's another interesting aspect to this as well. We've seen that the entire life now of Sarah, and here's Abraham, the promises that have been made to Abraham. He has the son of promise. He has Isaac. Isaac is probably pushing four decades old at this point. Sarah has passed. And yet all of this land that's been promised to him, as of just prior to this incident, he was still a stranger and a sojourner. There was nothing in that land that had been promised that he had yet in his lifetime seen. But now, as of this point, we have it. So I see a question on the screen. Do you ever consider that maybe Yahweh caused Ephron to recognize that the land already belonged to Abraham? Yeah, I honestly don't necessarily go there, Tom. I tend to think it's the other way around. I tend to think that it was very important that this be done the way it was. One, so that we have the example, and two, so that it would be written down, and so that all of these millennia later, we still have the reference, we still have the story. So had Ephron just said, I give it to you, would have been a whole different deal. The land now, though, has been, as Scripture says, made sure unto Abraham. All right, on to chapter 24. And here we're going to see kind of the second of the law and contract elements of this one. This, to some extent, is one of my favorites. And many of you have probably heard me teach this a number of times, so I'll try to do it just a little bit differently, but I'm going to belabor the same points that I always belabor because they are so important as well. And there are so many things about this story of Abraham and his servant that that we could go and talk about at great length. So I'm going to just mention a few of them in passing, and I'll probably spend a little bit more time on a couple aspects tomorrow and in the Shabbat teaching as well. But certainly as we go through it, I want to hit the highlights. Abraham was old, well stricken in age, and he had been blessed in, it says here, all things. Bekol, literally, in all. And as you might suspect, all things, well, what does that mean? He's wealthy, but Abraham's not the kind of guy that gets too caught up with physical wealth. He's lost his wife, Sarah, that he spent, decade after decade with. What does it mean that he has all things? Well, as you might suspect, there's a lot of spiritualization that goes on here, and I won't spend a lot of time on that other than to make this observation. Everything. He has some promises that have been made, and things that have been promised, you know, like the land we just finished talking about, that he doesn't have yet. Blessed with all things. Essentially, one of the things the Midrash says is, at the point where Abraham has now been said to have been blessed with all things, all of a sudden, it's like a switch gets thrown, and now he's going to go ahead and do something that, if you think about it, hasn't happened up until now. What's that? He's going to go out and get a bride for his son. He's got no grandchildren. This is the son of promise, but there aren't any sons of the son yet. Again, how can that be all things? The spiritual aspect of this is what the sages say. At this point, he has passed the test. This is how they put it. Remember, there are the Talmud, the Midrash, the claim is, and I'm not sure if I go all these places, you know, I tend to talk about, we try to be the church of no traditions. I'd like to see things, in Scripture as opposed to conjecture or some of the oral traditions that go with it. As you know, within the life of Abraham, there are all kinds of things people will tell you that are true, but that are not written in Scripture. Well, in any case, whether or not there were 10 tests or exactly what it means, something after this description of Abraham is blessed in all things now comes to pass to the point where, all right, very next verse says, now he is going to go send his servant out to get a bride for Isaac. And of course, the implication is that there's a spiritual blessing that is being referred to here with all things. And now that whatever that is has come to pass, now it's time to pass that legacy along to Isaac, to Yitzhak. So I don't have any problem with this concept of whatever Bekol in all things means. It certainly means it's time. Let's go get a bride for Isaac. And Abraham then says to his servant. Now, you notice one other thing about this, and this is another interesting aspect. We are going to see what it means in this next story when someone says, I come in the name of. In English, in modern legal terminology, we would say, this servant is going to carry Abraham's power of attorney. It's also called agency. He is going to act as Abraham's agent. Well, what does it mean in the old Hebrew? He is going to come in the name of Abraham. He's literally going to go out and make a deal, enter into yet another contract. This time it's going to be with a young woman of marriage. And at the point where Abraham's agent, now notice this isn't the principal. There's actually several people involved here. You got Isaac. He's the one that's going to actually end up with a wife, hopefully. He's got his dad that is going to actually make the deal for him. And then he's got his agent, the servant who has his power of attorney, that's going to go out and do the work. How's that for an interesting bunch of stuff all in the same story? Now, there's one other thing. Most of us would say, well, we know that the name of the servant of Abraham is Eliezer. And yet, you'll notice that in this story, not once does the servant get called by name. He's called the servant. He is called the man in some cases, but never by name. I can't tell you why that is, but I'm going to suggest a very good possible reason. It's the reason that I tend to believe. Again, your mileage may vary. Just see if it makes sense to you. I think the man's name isn't important here. What's important is the fact that he comes in the name of Abraham. When we talk about I come in the name of, or Yeshua comes in the name of, or various people come in the name of God, or come in the name of this or that, they're claiming essentially that they are acting as agent for that principle. They're doing what he would do were he physically there. Can you begin to see why in the Hebrew understanding, that's a pretty significant burden? You're going to claim to be someone's agent, to make a contract on their behalf. You'd better be doing what they want. Oh, and guess what? That's what we're going to see right up front here in verse 3. I will make you swear, says Abraham, to his gonna-be agent, the unnamed servant at this point. I'll make you swear by Yahuwah, Elohim of heaven and Elohim of Haaretz, the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from among the daughters of the Canaanites, the folks that are all over the place here. I want you to go back to my old home country, to my kin. Take a wife for my son, for Isaac, there. And the servant then says to him, well, suppose this woman won't be willing to follow me. That's a long ways, right? That's a fairly serious question. I'm going to go a long, long ways. She's going to have to come a long, long ways back. She's going to have to do what you did. Leave her home and her kin and go off to a place that she doesn't know to be with a man under his covering that she's never even met. I mean, isn't that a pretty tall order? Hey, by the way, that's one of the things I think makes this story so amazing. Well, what if she isn't willing to follow me? Do I need to bring your son back to the land? Now, here the sages say, whoa, danger, danger, Will Robinson. This might be one of the things Abraham is trying to avoid, because it just might be, and we're going to talk about the character of the people involved here later, but maybe he knows what some of those folks are like. Now, they're not quite the same as the Canaanites, but, you know, sometimes family can be a little bit shady, and we're going to find out Laban seems to be a fairly shady character. It seems, for whatever reason, that Abraham doesn't necessarily want Isaac to go. He'd rather bring whoever it's going to be, the bride, back this direction. So he says to him, beware, you're not to bring my son back that direction. Yahuwah, Elohim of heaven, who took me from my father's house, the land of my nativity, spoke to me, saying, to your seed am I going to give this land. He'll send his messenger, his malak, his angel before you, and you're to take a wife for my son from there. And if that woman is not willing to follow you, then you have been cleared. You've done your duty. Just don't bring my son back in that direction. And he says, now this is one of those other interesting things, literally put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master. Basically, we're talking about putting his hand pretty close to Abraham's private parts and make an oath, a solemn oath. And he did. So the servant took 10 camels of his master, and he departed. Now, what is verse 10 telling us? There are all kinds of things of his master's that he has now been entrusted with. He arose, he went to Aram Naharaim in the city of Nahor, and he made the camels kneel down, and this was about the time when the women are going out to the water. Let me pause before we get to the story of the obviously the miracle here. He has a whole bunch of stuff with him. He looks pretty wealthy. 10 camels will carry a lot of goods. So one of the things that is clear here about Abraham having sent the unnamed servant to act as his agent in his name and make a contract is he has given him all kinds of indications of ways to prove, if in sheer wealth alone, that he has some authority to do that. In other words, he wants this servant to look like a man of means, who can do what he says and make a contract that is good. How else would you expect anyone to believe? You know, if somebody shows up and says, trust me, I'm dressed poorly, I ain't got squat here, and it's going to be a rugged trip home, you know, just you and me and a camel. But when we get there, I got all kinds of good stuff waiting. No, he's got the goods. He's come fully equipped to do what he needs to do. So, he makes the camels kneel down. And he says, he prays, O Yahuwah, Elohim of my master Abraham, send me, I pray, good speed this day. Show kindness, chesed, unto my master Abraham. I stand by the fountain of the water. And then basically what he does is he says, look, when I give my camels, I'm getting ready to give my camels some water here. So let it pass that some woman, some damsel is going to come on out and she will volunteer to give my camels drink. And let that be the one that you have appointed for Isaac. And that way I will know. That'll be the sign, the indicator of what is going on here. So it came to pass, before he was even done speaking, how's that for an answer? Behold, here comes Rivka, born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother. She's got her pitcher on her shoulder. She was a beautiful woman, a virgin, nice looking. Neither had any man known her. It actually says it in kind of two different ways. She went, the word there, by the way, again, of course, is yada. To know in the intimate sense. She went down to the fountain. She filled her pitcher. She came up. The servant ran to meet her, and he said, can you give me something to drink, I pray? A little pitcher from your, a little water from your pitcher? Well, drink, my lord, she says. And then, after giving him drink, she said, hey, I'll go get water for your camels too, till they are done drinking. And she hastened, emptied her pitcher, and she ran and drew water for each of his 10 camels. Let me pause a second here. Did the math on this years ago. Evidently, camels, as you probably know, can tank down a lot of water. And it looks like, just some kind of rough figures, what she committed to do was hand carry, about 140 gallons of water. That's 355-gallon barrels, practically. That's over half a ton. About 1,100 pounds or so, give or take, of water. This is no small feat. And the man, here he is, not being named again, looked steadfastly upon her. He kept his mouth shut to know whether Yahuwah had made his journey prosperous or not. And then it came to pass when the camels were done, he took a golden ring, half a shekel in weight, two bracelets for her hands of 10 shekels in weight of gold. This is a small fortune. And he said, whose daughter are you? Tell me, is a room in your father's house for us to lodge? And she tells him that she's the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore unto Nahor. Yep, we got plenty of room, straw, provender stuff, room to lodge in. So he gives thanks to Yahuwah. And the damsel ran. She told her mother's house all the things that had happened. Rivka has a brother, turns out. You know his name? His name is Laban. He ran out to the man, to the fountain. And here we see another glimpse right away into the character. I get a smile when I read the way the scripture lays this out for us. And having read it many, many times at this point, you can almost picture this guy, I think. It came to pass, it says, that when he saw the ring and the bracelets upon his sister's hands, and he heard the words of Rivka, his sister, saying, here's what the man said to me, that he came, and he stood by the camels at the fountain. Yeah, this guy seems to be pretty well-to-do. Come on in, he says. You must be blessed of Yahuwah. Why stand outside? I got the house ready, made room for the camels. And then, this is where the plot thickens even a little bit more. I remembered, having read this, says the man came into the house, ungirded the camels, and he gave straw and provender for the camels, water to wash their feet and the feet of the men that were with him. Wait a second, which man are we talking about here? Is it the man that came out, i.e. Laban, or is it the man who's been called the man other places, the servant, who went and had to wash the feet and do all the work on the camels? I've always assumed it was probably Laban. Oh, yeah, the rich guy, I'm going to do all this stuff for him. But essentially, some of the sages say, no. The man is referring to the unnamed servant, probably Eliezer. He's the one that came into the house, ungirded the camels, and gave them all straw, and so forth. Then there was food set before him to eat. Sounds like we're talking about the same guy, doesn't it? Sounds like Laban came out, says, come on in, here, go on in and take care of your camels, and then when you're done, yeah, we'll get you some food. I won't eat, though, he says, until I have spoken my errand. So do so. Speak on. And the speech follows. I'm Abraham's servant. In other words, I come in the name of my master. Yahuwah has blessed him greatly. He has become great. He's got all kinds of stuff, flocks and herds, silver and gold, men servants, maid servants, camels and asses, and Sarah, my master's wife. And this family probably remembers both of them, at least the older ones do. She bore a son to my master when he was old, and he has given that son all that he has. And my master has made me swear, saying, I'm not to take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, the ones that are in the land that we dwell in. No, I'm going to go unto this land, my father's house, my kin, take a wife for my son. That was the charge that was given to me. And I asked, what if this woman won't follow me? And he said, not to worry. Yahuwah and his angel, before whom I walk, the messenger, will prosper your way. Take a wife for my son, from my kin, the house of my father. And if you do that, then you'll be clear of this oath. And if she doesn't, if they won't give her to you, or if she won't come, you know, there you go. So he continues the story. Now, one of the things as I go through the story briefly I want to point out, too, is it has been noted that when we see the story told by the servant to Laban and his house, it's pretty much the same story. I mean, he's telling a truthful rendition of the story. But if you actually look line by line and compare what it says here that the servant is telling Laban and company to what it says, you know, from the perspective of the Almighty, what really happened, there's some slight differences. And it's those slight differences that really are key. In other words, just a little bit of a way that the servant makes his pitch tells us a whole lot about the character of all the people involved here. So here's what I said. I prayed, O Yahuwah, the God of my master Abraham, if you will now prosper the way which I go, I must stand by this fountain and let it come to pass that the maiden who comes forth will say, after I ask her for a little water, she'll say to me, you drink, and I'll also draw for your camels. And I asked, let that same woman be the one that my master's Elohim has appointed for my master's son. And behold, hey, check it out, man. Before I was done speaking, here comes Rivka with her pitcher on her shoulder. And she said exactly what I had been asking for. She made haste. She let down her pitcher. She said, drink, and I will also give some drink to your camels. And so then I asked her, whose daughter are you? And she said, I'm the daughter of Bethuel. So, you know, we've heard a lot of this. I bowed my head, I prostrated myself before Yahuwah and blessed Yahuwah, God of my master Abraham, who had led me the right way to take this woman, my master's brother's daughter, for his son. So now, if you'll deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. If not, tell me so that I can basically turn to the right hand or to the left. Well, then Laban and Bethuel answered, and they said, this thing comes from Yahuwah. We can't speak unto you bad or good, but here, behold, Rivka's right there. Take her and go. Let her be your master's son wife, as Yahuwah has spoken. And it came to pass. Now, wait a second. Let's pause. What do we got here? We got offer and acceptance. He's told the story. He's made the offer. The offer is an offer of marriage. Here she is. Take her and go. It comes to pass that when Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself down unto Yahuwah. And he brought forth all kinds of stuff, jewels, silver, gold, raiment. He gave them to Rivka. He also gave them to Laban, her brother, and to her mother, all these precious things. And they ate and they drank, and the men that were with him, they tarried all night long. They had quite a party. They rose up in the morning, and he says, all right, thanks, guys. Time to head out. Send me away unto my master. Well, wait a minute. Whoop. Her brother and her mother says, well, no, not so fast. So let the damsel abide with us a few days, at least 10. After that, then she can go. And he says, don't delay me, seeing Yahuwah has prospered my way. Send me away. I need to go to my master. Well, we will call the damsel and inquire at her mouth. Now, at this point, I want to pause and just make one other comment here. Essentially, And I didn't go through it in quite the level of detail that some of the sages have, and pointed out, as I mentioned, though, there are a few slight differences, including one specific word that appears in the first part of the story from the perspective of the Almighty that doesn't appear in the second part. And essentially it has to do with a difference of emphasis. In other words, first time through the story, the emphasis is on this character that we see so often reflected in the life of Abraham, chesed, kindness. It is the thing that the servant is carrying, this concept of kindness. It's central to what he's doing. And yet, when he tells the story to Laban, you get the impression he kind of figures kindness isn't going to resonate with this guy. Now, what's going to resonate with Laban is goodies, wealth, the material stuff. He recognizes a gold digger, I guess, when he sees one. Is that probably fair? I know that there would be some of the sages say, well, no, Laban's, he's basically an okay guy. Maybe so. But the scripture certainly doesn't emphasize this concept of chesed, of kindness, in his character. And presumably, Abraham would remember that and would have known that. Maybe that's part of the reason, maybe, why he didn't want Isaac to come, why he wanted to send an agent instead. But it seems like the following. Seems like this woman, Rivka, she's got a whole different spirit in her. She comes out, and off the top, she volunteers to water this fellow's camels. Never saw him before in her life. Now, I've had people say, oh, well, you know, she was probably looking for a husband. Here's a wealthy guy. Maybe this is the game she plays with everybody who comes through town. Well, perhaps, but I'm not necessarily buying that. There's a reason, at least, why the scripture makes a big deal of pointing out that was the prayer of the servant, and that was exactly what Rivka did. Certainly, it fits like a hand in a glove. But why that particular understanding? Well, it would seem that, in other words, Rivka is a woman who also understands chesed. And here's what I liked about this, and what I saw in some of the commentaries that really resonated with me. What is it about Abraham that sets him apart? Well, clearly he is a man that is not just a stranger in a strange land, but he is a guy that demonstrates kindness in a land where it's not the default situation. Think Sodom and Gomorrah, where visitors were more likely to get raped than they were treated with kindness, where they were more likely to be robbed and sent off to places that they don't want to go than to be treated with kindness. Abraham's kind of a square peg in a round hole. He's a man of kindness in a land that isn't so kind. And what are we seeing with Rivka? Isn't that amazing? In a land where her brother seems to be kind of a gold digger, and the impression that makes the deal is, how much have you got? Got a lot of good stuff there, a lot of wealth, a lot of gold, a lot of jewels. Oh, yeah, yeah. That was the way that the servant emphasized what was happening here, rather than kindness. And Rivka, on the other hand, kind of sticks out there. She, too, like Abraham, in other words, is in a place of not kindness, but demonstrates that anyway. Can you imagine a better bride to bring home to Isaac? I guess that's the bottom line. And at this point, we see that character demonstrated one more time. The servant wants to head on out. He knows that there's a game being played here. Who knows what's going to happen after 10 days? But that's certainly a whole bunch more days where they can say, no, bring Isaac back this direction. For all of the reasons that we can speculate about, and for reasons we probably don't know, it makes sense that he wants to get gone. And furthermore, it makes sense that having agreed to the contract and having the kind of character that we see in Rivka, she's ready to go too. So they say, let's call her, ask her. And they called Rivka and they said unto her, will you go with this man? And she says, yes, I will go. And she's ready to go now. So they sent Rivka away, their sister and her nurse and Abraham's servant and all of his men. And they blessed her and they said to her, our sister, be the mother of thousands of 10,000s. Let your seed possess the gate of those who hate them. And Rivka arose and the damsels, and they rode upon the camels, and they followed the man, and the servant took Rivka and went his way. Now, pause, full stop, and a couple of comments back to this idea of law and contract. I'm going to suggest to you that, well, a couple things. When is the deal done? You could make several points. There was offer and acceptance. The deal is done there. But I think everybody rested a little bit easier that it was really truly done at the point where Rivka got on the camels. When Rebecca loads up on the camels and they head out, she is betrothed. She has a husband. And she's never even met him. The contract is made. It has not yet been consummated. So when it comes to this concept of marriage, and this is something we're going to see throughout the Torah, at the point where she has agreed, offer and acceptance, she got on the camel, there's the walking it out, if you will, not just saying it with her mouth, but doing it. She is Yitzhak's wife. Had somebody come and taken her, it would have been adultery at that point, even though it's not been consummated. So, she follows the man, and they go. They take the long journey, and fast forward a couple days, no doubt. Here comes Isaac from the way of Be'er Lahai Roy. He dwelt in the land of the south. He comes out to meditate in the field at evening, lifts up his eyes, and behold, there's some camels coming. I bet he's excited. Rivka lifts up her eyes. She saw Isaac. She got off the camel, and she said to the servant, "What is this man that walks in the field out here to meet us?" And the servant says, notice he's still the servant, "It's my master." She took her veil, and she covered herself, and the servant told Isaac all of the things that he had done. Now, verse 67 here is one of these that I'm going to point to, got highlighted, and I'm going to suggest a couple things. Again, your mileage may vary. See if this resonates with you, if it makes sense. But here is the point that I want to try to make. We have seen people in Scripture, Adam and Eve, definitely a match, if you will, made in heaven or at the hand of the Creator, literally a person from whom another woman was taken. We know the whole story. A little bit unique, if you will, in human history. Here's a man and a woman, probably the only two ever to be joined in matrimony that don't have belly buttons. Different from every other wedding that follows. When we meet Abraham, he's Abram at that point. He has Sarai. He's got a wife, but we don't hear anything about it. You know, how did he meet her? What happened? What was the ceremony like? You know, did he go to the justice of the peace? I don't think he did. We don't know any of the details of the contract or of the covenant. So this is the first time in Scripture where we see, just like the land deed, where we see the entire process. And now we get to literally the culmination of the process here in verse 67. And I will suggest to you that everything about this is important. No idle word in Scripture. The following happened. And listen to the order and contrast this with what we see in so-called marriages today. Isaac brought her, Rivka, Rebecca, into his mother Sarah's tent. And he, the word here, that root word, lechach, took her. That's a physical act. He took her, and he took her. And then it says, she became his Isha. Let's pause. There are several steps here. He took her into his mother's tent. He took her. He had conjugal relations. The marriage was consecrated and consummated. And then it says, and she became his Isha, his woman, his wife. In that order. No marriage license, no nothing. The contract was done, and what we're seeing here is the final part of the process, the consummation. And then it says this. Now, how's this for being out of order with what America with a K says you gotta have nowadays? And he loved her. Wait a minute. Well, no, you gotta love her first. And then you test drive her. And then later on, then you go to the justice of the peace, you get a license from another god, and then you make it legal. You make an honest woman out of her. What a crock, folks. How backwards, how twisted is that? And maybe it helps to explain why it is we have such a an upside-down understanding of covenant and marriage and so much divorce and so much other stuff, because we don't get any of the process right and the order is completely wrong. He had a contract first with a woman at this point that he'd never even met. Now, it's a truly amazing thing, because we probably know more about her character as a result of what we've read in the story than we know than a lot, let's just put it this way, of people who have more wives and or adulterous relationships and or who knows what by the time they're 18 than they know what to do with, and don't know much about the character of any of them, even though they may have known them in a physical sense. Very important understanding. A law and contract example that, if we would pay attention, really teaches us a lot more than we're going to see on TV, for sure. He brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. He took Rebecca, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Oh, and then it says this, too, and Yitzhak was comforted for his mother. All right, at this point I want to pause. We've only got a little bit more of the portion to go. We'll go through that briefly. As I've mentioned, there's a whole lot that could be said about any number of elements of the story here. We're going to see other things in the Torah that are going to outline more about marriage. We're going to have more about contract. But as far as the, if you will, the parable, the examples, the proof texts that give us a living, breathing way to understand the things that we're going to give as instruction later in the form of laws and commandments. Here's how you do this. Here's how you do this. Well, now we've seen how those things play out. Now, chapter 25 is interesting. It begins by saying, Abraham, lechak, he took another wife. Do we have an understanding of probably what that looked like? He may have done this one in person without having to use agency and power of attorney. We don't know. Maybe we've already seen enough detail that we get the impression. But it says that her name was Keturah. There has been, as I'm sure probably most of you are aware, a whole lot of speculation. Who is this woman? We don't know a whole lot about her. There are some that suggest, and I would say they may or may not be right, but the evidence as far as Scripture is concerned is a little bit sketchy on this score. Some claim that this is Hagar, and she's just been renamed. Yeah. I don't have an opinion, because I can't prove it one way or another. Anyway, we do know the following. Abraham's got about another 40 good years with this wife. She bore him a number of sons: Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And then it gives the genealogy of those sons bore other sons. The sons of Midian, the Midianites, right? Ephah, Epher, Hanach, Abidah, Eldaah, children of Keturah. And verse 5 tells us, Abraham gave all coal that he had to Isaac. But Abraham, had concubines, and he had sons through those concubines. To them, he didn't give so much as, I guess you'd say there's a distinction here being made, not an inheritance, but gifts. He sent them away eastward into the east country. So Abraham's got, at this point, not just the descendants through Isaac and then later through Yaakov, through Israel, but other sons that we have the genealogy at least outlined here through Keturah, and other concubines too. And he sent those all out into the world. And then finally, verse 7 tells us, the days of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Good long life. He died in a good old age, old man full of years, and was gathered to his people. And now we kind of have a touching end to the portion, because what it tells us is, remember Ishmael? Long time ago, sent away. There does seem to be a reconciliation of sorts here. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the same place we just saw the story about the contract and the land deed, in the cave of Machpelah, the field of Ephron, son of Zohar the Hittite, before Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased from the children of Heth. There he was, buried, along with Sarah his wife. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that Elohim blessed Isaac, his son. And Isaac dwelt at the place. This is part of the reason why perhaps people suggest maybe Keturah might have been one and the same with Hagar. Because the place where he dwells, Be'er Lahai Roy, means the well of the living vision. But admittedly, to my mind, that's a little bit of a stretch. We don't know for sure. And that brings us to the end of the portion.